The Spectator's podcast now have a newsletter. Sign up for free at spectator.co.uk/podcast-highlights to get the Spectator's podcast highlights in your inbox every Monday.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. So it's the day after Rishi Sunak's statement and the papers are still going over the details of it. Katie, this morning he went on to the broadcast round and the headlines that are coming out are saying that he's refusing to rule out tax rises. So we're going into quite a painful couple of decades.
There are obviously a few interpretations of this. This is a story which is based on him not saying something. So, you know, he hasn't said there are going to be tax rises. He hasn't said there are not going to be tax rises. Ergo, you've got, you know, every news website running a piece saying the Chancellor is refusing to rule out tax increases. Now, I think it would be a strange situation if a Chancellor said there are not going to be any tax rises for the entire time they are Chancellor. Obviously, you need to give yourself a leeway. If you look at the triple lock, something Boris Johnson this week said would stay in place because it's the manifesto. As soon as you make promises like that, you have very little wriggle room when there are problems, you know, coming up the track. So I think that if you look at yesterday, which is obviously a high spend, not really a revenue raising statement, and it was never really intended to be because it's about trying to get the economy going, you just need to join a few dots to think that at some point we're going to have to pay for all this. We did a Coffee House Shots live event, if I got started, and you know, we had a few members in the audience or the virtual audience bring up this point, which is, you know, how is everything being paid for unless we are just only borrowing? And I think that seems unlikely. The question is, when do these tax rises come in and who do they affect? And I think that some people are saying autumn's going to be a difficult budget. I don't think it necessarily is going to be where they will want to do difficult decisions. It will depend so much on the economic outlook. If the country is not back to, you know, some state of normal by the autumn, if there is a rise in infections, it's hard to see, oh, we're going into a second wave and we're raising taxes. I think it's a hard thing to envision. So it's interesting listening to some of the ideas coming from the Institute for Fiscal Studies today. And you have the IFS suggesting that, you know, tax rises will have to come, they think, to balance this all out, but probably not, you know, for actually this year, maybe next year, because ultimately we're not in a normal recession. So this normal timeline doesn't quite apply, but eventually something's going to have to give.
James, is it difficult to predict what is going to have to give, as it were, given that we don't know when a vaccine is going to come? I mean, does the Treasury know what its long-term plan is to pay for
this? I think it all
depends
how much smaller the economy is at the end of this than it was before, because there's often a bit of confusion about this. There are two different things, right? One is the amount of money the government is borrowed to pay for things like the furlough. That for the scheme is going to be wound up in October. And I think the government's attitude is frankly just to add that to the national debt, pay that back very slowly over a long period of time. If you look at how low interest rates are, I think the government is quite comfortable doing that. So they're not going to try and pay back all the money they borrowed to fund these schemes straight away. But what I think they would not be able to do, because the markets wouldn't let them get away with it, is to run a structural deficit after this crisis. So the big question then becomes, is the economy going to be smaller after this crisis? And it probably is. And if so, how much smaller? Because that's the gap that the government needs to make up, either through spending restraint or through revenue raises. That is what we don't know right now. But kind of 64 million, probably a lot larger than that, dollar question is, how big is that going to be? Because the OBR's initial work basically suggested there was, that the economy is basically going to be the same size once the crisis was over. The Bank of England, I think, has suggested a kind of one, I can't remember if it's 1 or 1.5% smaller. The IMF has suggested 3% smaller. So that is the question. How much smaller is the economy? And therefore, how much spending either needs to be restrained by or revenue needs to be increased by to make up for that? I think that right now, we don't really have any idea how much smaller the economy is going to be because we're still in this crisis. We don't know when the recovery is going to come and how sustained it will be.
Now, Katie, earlier this week on the podcast, we talked about your scoop that Andrew Bailey, the governor of Bank of England, was due to speak to the 1922 committee. Obviously, that was rescheduled, but you've got updates for us on that.
I think when it was rescheduled, some took it as a sign that potentially it would be rescheduled to a very far away date.
But sense have prevailed.
Far in the future, given the complications of addressing MPs generally, but particularly a behind closed doors meeting with only Conservative MPs when you are supposed to be independent. And also everything you say is incredibly market sensitive. As we have seen with all behind closed door meetings, you know, half a sentence trickles out. You know, sometimes you don't get the comprehensive picture, so that could cause problems. But instead, it has simply been rescheduled till next Wednesday. I think in fairness to the Bank of England governor, he is also planning to speak to the Parliamentary Labour Party. So I think they will say that this is not, you know, partisan because there are different audiences. But all these meetings are behind closed doors. So I think it will be interesting really how you hold the line doing that, when it's not a completely transparent conversation. And we all know that MPs do leak things from these events. I think since Andrew Bailey was going to speak for the 1922, then didn't, but now is again, some thought, well, this is a mad thing to do because it makes him look too close to the Tory party at a time when the bank and the government have never been closer because of the quantitative easing, because the bank has been directly funding the government through the ways and means. But I actually think there is another interpretation. That's something I touched on in my I column this week, which is, if anything, I think what the Bank of England governor might be trying to do is show that he is independent. For example, when it was first announced, so when we reported on Coffee House this week that he was going to speak before the 1922, I think that came as news to many people in the Treasury. So lots of people thought it was coordinated because it was a strange thing to happen. But actually, I think they were fairly out of the loop on it. And if you look at the other interventions Andrew Bailey has made, so appearing on former Chancellor Sajid Javid's podcast, I don't think these are things where...
Not as good as this one.
He is very welcome on this podcast. But I think that, you know, they're not in sync. If anything, I think he is trying to carve his own path to suggest that he isn't telling the government everything. He is making his own decisions because that there is a level of independence. But it does raise questions, and it is fairly unusual, some of these things.
And James, speaking of the Labour Party, does all this put them in a bit of a sticky position on how to tackle this? We, on the weekly podcast, the Edition podcast, I just spoke to Kate Andrews and Miatta Fambule, who is the economist at the left-leaning New Economics Foundation, where Miatta was the one defending the government.
I think this is difficult for Labour because there's not a huge amount of space for them to go to because the government is spending astronomical sums of money to support the economy. I thought that Annalisa Dodds' response yesterday, I thought the only bit when she got going and that actually appeared to have a coherent argument when she basically said all of this is all well and good, but if you can't control the virus it isn't going to make any difference. And I think it is quite interesting how Labour's essential argument is whatever on the economy stuff, but you can't, if your public health stuff isn't working, so it won't work. That I think is Labour's best line of attack. I think it is quite hard for them because they are trying to argue that, you know, it should continue the furlough in affected sectors. I think there are some fairly good arguments against that. I think it's also hard to look at this and argue that the government are not being generous in trying to keep jobs going. I mean, for crying out loud, they are literally paying companies to hire 16 to 24-year-olds. You bring a worker back off furlough and keep them in work until January, you get given £1,000. I mean, this is quite clearly a government that is doing lots of big things to try and prevent mass unemployment. But I think where Labour is right is perhaps the biggest determinant of the future of the British economy is how under control is the virus and, you know, how successful is test and trace and all those kind of things.
But Katie, I guess the economy is just not doing nearly as well as people hope it would be. And today we've had the latest example of that with John Lewis saying that they're going to be axing 1,500 jobs from a few stores.
Yeah, so they're closing 8 of the stores, 1,300 workers. Every day, if you look for it, you don't have to look particularly hard. You can find a story of a company announcing likely redundancies and potentially store closures. And I think it just does go back to it, which is the chance of the claim that sorts of measures. But at the moment, we're just not in a place, because there are so many components to this, the public health crisis, where people are going out and, you know, taking up them all, but also going out and shopping in a way they previously would. I mean, I went to Westfield the other weekend. It's got a great social life. But I was also just intrigued as to what Westfield would look like in social distancing. And they had a one-way system, it was very well organised, they had all these circles on the ground for socially distanced queuing to get into closed shops. There was a long socially distanced queue for Primark particularly. You can't look at it and you can't help but wonder, how is this brand going to make anything close to the same turnover if they could only let XX number in? People can't really try on the clothes in lots of these places. And if you are, you know, a certain type of... even if you manage to get people to your shop, which is the first hurdle, is not the same experience, and you are massively limiting the number of customers you can have. So I think that retail, I mean, hospitality we spoke about yesterday is obviously very badly affected, but I think retail is also badly affected by this. And the problem is, it's not just public trust, it's also while we have social distancing, we are changing our habits. And even if we want to have the same habits, so again, not to go all about my journey to Westfield, but after a while you just give up going into shops because you have to queue for 25 minutes and you're not sure you necessarily want to buy something. Even if you like shopping in person, it's pushing people to look online. We might recreate certain jobs through this, but it is hard to imagine the high street as we know it being anything like it was, you know, in 6 months' time.
I was talking to someone who works in retail the other day, and they basically said we've had 10 years of the decline of a high street, essentially, contained within this lockdown, because a couple of reasons. First of all, people who had not previously shopped online because they worried about the security of their credit card, or they were slightly older, not hugely comfortable, they've now basically been forced to make the transition by this period. And once you've done it, once you've got over that hurdle, it's so convenient, you're going to do it again more and more. Secondly, I think that, you know, the high street was in trouble before this crisis hit. I think what this crisis has done is been a catalyst. It's accelerated changes that were already underway. And one of them was the high street is going to become a very different thing. I think in 10 years' time, there'll be more people living on the high street because shops will be turned into flats or houses. It's really going to be about restaurants, bars, rather than physical retail of shops and things like that. I think the other problem as well is you look at a lot of the big purchases you make in John Lewis, you get them delivered to you anyway. You're not going in to kind of impulse buy. And I think one thing, interestingly, on Katie's point about Westfield that someone in retail was saying to me, is what you saw was there was an initial surge of shoppers, of people basically buying basics that they hadn't been able to get hold of, really simple things that they needed, they wanted to try on or something like that. But again, that's now eased off. The number of people who have made the jump to shopping online and realised how convenient it is, and also shops have got much better at online returns, all of those things. And I think that is a real problem for physical retail.
Yeah, and on a very basic level, if you go into a shop and you can't try on the clothes, what is the difference between that and buying online, apart from maybe touching the fabric? And I think that's still quite frowned upon.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I went to a shop on last weekend and I was scared to touch anything.
So I think it is an argument, it's a different experience, but right now it's not particularly so. Something has to give, I think, for it to have a chance.
I also think that as the returns policy changes, people are now buying, obviously it only works if you've got enough money to do this, but you buy six things, you return five of them, you keep the one that fits, right? I think this is becoming an increasingly common phenomenon.
And in the midst of this gloomy economic outlook, we find out today that Mark Sedwell, the outgoing Cabinet Secretary, is being paid £250,000 as his severance pay. Katie, what do you make of this?
This is a taxpayer-funded payment. I think, given that he is leaving, it seems, ahead of schedule, all the perhaps off-the-record briefings rather than on suggest that that is because they did not think that he was fulfilling his job to the necessary degree. And when he was appointed, it was not through the same procedure because of circumstances. It was a rush through. And he was also the first person to hold those, you know, both the job of Cabinet Secretary and also security advisor. It is an interesting use of taxpayers' money. I think if you're looking at why the figure is so high, I mean, the government in 2015 promised to cap public sector payoffs at £95,000. It was never implemented. But I do think clearly it's a drop in the ocean if you look at the amounts being spent these days. But I still think it's just not a particularly good look to have that much going out. Someone who potentially, and again, we don't know the ins and outs, but there is a reason they are no longer in that position. So Robert Peston has suggested that he thinks this means that Sedwell likely threatened to take the government to an employment tribunal because it's hard otherwise to understand why they would go so high in the payout. So, I mean, the government have got what they want. They are getting someone else in, but it clearly has come at a price, not perhaps just to them, to all of us.
James, the skeleton's in the closet.
The size of his payout, first of all, suggests that, you know, the letters exchanged between Boris Johnson and Mark Sedwell and try to suggest that the two of them had discussed this and kind of come to a mutual. I mean, it's quite clear that that's not the case. People with knowledge of these civil service schemes suggest that the payout would not be this large if that was the case. It definitely implies that Mark Sedwell was not hugely keen to go. I think in the grand scheme of things, if at the end of this government becomes more efficient and more effective, the £250,000 will not seem like much, but I think it is not a great look for the government. You've got Philip Rutland, the former perm sec at the Home Office, you know, still threatening to take the government to an employment tribunal. You've got this payout. This doesn't suggest that everything is an entirely happy ship between civil servants and politicians at the top of government.
James and Katie, thanks very much. And thanks for listening to this episode of Coffee House Shots. And do join us again tomorrow.
Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.